whatever questions, answer all the questions that the students or the audience had come up with a single idea, no matter what the questions were. And so Topol was a form of performance art, which I had not previously attempted. I'm actually going to attempt quite the same thing tonight. What happened tonight, actually, is for some reason I had one title in my head as to what the show was supposed to be, which was some kind of orthodox response to the challenges of higher and lower biblical criticism. But it turns out the real title was Science and History. It was the Bible, Science and History. So I had to try and find a way which I can get both sure and simultaneously. So it's kind of a little bit of a trick to try and think out loud as I'm doing that. Okay. So this is the third part of the series, and I want to try and put it in context. So the first year I gave was Is Gracious About Philosophy? And what I tried to argue in the context of that year was that there was at least one narrative in the book of Gracious, namely the story of Migdal Babel, which could be best understood and really couldn't be understood well any other way as being about the abstract question of the origin of language. Okay, it seemed to me that if you could demonstrate that there was an element of the Book of Bereshit which could really be far better understood if we thought of them in abstract philosophy, than if it was about anything else, then it's reasonable to say, okay, at least one of the things Bereshit is about is philosophy. The second share I gave was called Is Bereshit Literature, and what I tried to show in that share was that you can't understand Bereshit properly unless you acknowledge that it is written using the techniques that any author of any book written in language would use. All right, so the question in Bereshit literature is sort of the answer is yes, but recognizing that literature encompasses a vast array of books, textbooks of literature, silly songs of literature, it just means that Bereshit is not unconcerned with technique. It's not designed to convey whatever information it has to give you, and it's your own responsibility to organize it, or for that matter, to give any form of artistic interest. Bereshit tries to hold your interest like any other book. And what it means to ask the question, is Bereshit about science or about history? So let's start by asking the question, is Bereshit about science? Now that's a question that presumably relates only to the first several prakim of Bereshit. Nobody thinks that the story of Avraham is looking out is about are about science. So what would it mean to ask the question, is Bereshit about science? So the first thing I want to say, is to narrow that question down, is that I'm only interested in those aspects of Bereshit that are available to people on the assumption that Bereshit is written in language. It might be true that if you took every fifth letter in Bereshit, the result would be a microbiology textbook. Okay. It's possible. Right? I have myself never checked, and I don't know microbiology well enough in Hebrew or English. But I could probably tell that it was a microbiology textbook. If I tried it in an English book, in a Hebrew book, I would have no way of knowing. So the purpose of this year had no interest to me. Okay, I'm assuming that I'm only interested in those aspects of Bereshit that are accessible to ordinary language. So, for example, Kabbalistic claims, right, that Bereshit, that all the all the secrets of creation are actually available through some kind of numerological analysis or by analyzing the shapes of letters or anything like that is utterly uninteresting to me in the purpose of this year. But it might be interesting to me in other contexts, but the purpose of this year, I'm interested in whether the language aspect of Bereshit is about science. Okay, second issue is that there is a difference between saying that the intent of Bereshit is to convey science, and alternatively saying that the intent of Bereshit is not about science at all, but nonetheless we are committed to the scientific accuracy of Bereshit. Okay, I'll give you a mashal of a text that I'm very fond of, entirely different. I'm just using it as an excuse to get this text in. So one of my favorite midrashim is the following story, that we all know the narrative of Yitzchak's daughters in Sefer Shoftim, in which Yitzchak, prior to going out to war, pledges that the first thing that comes to the door of his house, he'll offer as a sacrifice to God. It turns out that his daughter is the first thing to come out of his house, and the question now is he or is he not compelled to offer his daughter as a sacrifice to God? So the Midrash asks, why didn't he just go to a chacham and have his neder? No! Right? Why wasn't he not the neder, right? So it should be, when you take an oath, there's almost always a halachic way out. Okay, so the Talmud says, well, yeah, he actually thought about that. And in his days, the high priest was Pinchas ben Aharon, the same Pinchas that we know as a zealot from the book of Bamidbar. And he sent a message to Pinchas saying, will you please come and be my friend, my neder, undo my vow. And Pinchas said, well, you know, I'm the high priest. You're just some illegitimate child who was randomly elected as a political leader. Why should I come to you? You should come to me. And then, but Yitzchak said, what do you mean? I'm a political leader, right? You're the high priest, right? I treat myself logically as a king, and we all know that the honor of the king, right, takes precedence over all the honors. You better come to me. So they went back and forth, and the conclusion of the Midrash is that Benchdehem and the Hanara, right, because, right, between the two of them, the goal was lost. Okay, now this is, to me, a tremendously important Midrash to understanding, you know, the extent to which the rabbis understood feminism. It's a really cool Midrash about how two men's egos two men get caught up in their egos and women get lived out in the interim. And in those realms, it has tremendous value in its own right. But what I'm interested in here right now is, does one have to have a vow to kill somebody annulled in order not to be responsible to kill somebody? Or is it the case that if I take an oath to kill somebody, halachically, that if in fact I can't get a panel of rabbis to annul it, that I am then obligated to go out and kill that person? Okay, now I'm taking the premise here that the story of Jephthah's daughter is in fact intended to, the outcome of the story of Jephthah's daughter is in fact that she's supposed to be killed as opposed to that she's supposed to remain unmarried for the duration of her existence. Okay, so let's assume that, right, and so the outcome is, which I think is clear in the Midrash, this Midrash assumes that Yitzhak in fact killed his daughter because he is obviously obligated to kill his daughter because he has taken an oath to do so and his oath has not been annulled. Now, no one would, I think, contend that the purpose of this Midrash is to teach me about the importance of maintaining one's oath even when they pose ethical challenges. I think that's a very hard, that's not what the Midrash is about. Right? They ask me, is the Midrash about the laws of oaths? No, the Midrash is not about the laws of oaths. But the kind of different question is it possible that in fact one does not have to take annul oaths to murder people? Oaths to murder people are, it's for the fact of null and void because they're no joke to negative Torah. But this Midrash doesn't care about that. Because for the purposes of the point that Midrash is making, we can forgive halakhic inaccuracy. Right? It seems to me clear that halakha is not that if you take an oath to kill somebody that you have, right, that failing an element you have to kill them. So this is a case where the Midrash is not primarily interested in the halakhic point, but the Midrash is actually uninterested in halakhic accuracy. Right? It just means what I call halakhic verisimilitude. Right? It has to look something like halakha, sufficiently for what I call the willing suspension of halakhic disbelief. Right? People can go along with it. Yes, or Edmund.
I'm just wondering, why should we look at the Midrash in that way if we can have total accuracy? Let's rather say that Yitzhak's case was very different from the average ordinary person. The situation was a unique one in which a battle was won. God did his part, so to speak. And he thought that he actually was really bound. And perhaps in his particular case he was. But for us, you know, if we would make such a note, then it would be understood that the fact that it was not Yitzhak.
So I have a number of reasons not to want to do that. One is that once you allow, under any circumstances, an oath to kill somebody to be binding, you always run the risk that your students will decide that their circumstances match your own. Right? Anything like that is, you can say all you want, it can't be true, but it might. And secondly, there's a question, do I feel compelled? Is it a value to me to read Midrashic narrative as being always philosophically accurate, or am I comfortable saying that part of the genre of the Gadic Midrash is that you're allowed to engage in poetic license regarding the Holocaust. Okay, guys? That's what, my tendency is to think the latter, because I think the attempt to explain why it could be binding has so many dangerous halakhic ramifications. It's so easily abused by having people who want to do things that are forbidden, just say go to do them and say, well, I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm stuck, right? You can't make me not do it. I'm not willing to ask you not to do my neder. I'm just asking you whether I have to go ahead and do this. I don't want my hand to be forced that way. Okay, that one, Chris, yes.
I mean, it seems that what's the lesson in the Midrash connects with the lesson of story in terms of being careful that your own pride doesn't blind you into getting you into a stupid situation.
Yeah. Oh.
And the story itself is very obscure in terms of what happens after, but very clear what happens before. He's I'm going to go off this war, and I'm going to go make this husband, it's going to be great, but he doesn't think ahead of time of what's going to happen, what could happen later. So same thing afterwards, they're not thinking about what's going to happen down the road. There are this little arguments amongst themselves. So, I think it's focused on the before and more so than the after.
Okay.
The after is obscure.
Could be. I'm fine. Yeah, I tend to read it more to a more explicitly feminist one. But the issue I'm thinking is literally, do I have to care about making the halakha of this story match halakha? And the analogy is, right, so I have the question of whether Bereshit is about science, is the purpose of the first chapter of Genesis to teach me about the order of creation. And the second third question is, even if I come to the conclusion that the purpose of the first chapter of creation, the second and third for that matter, is not to teach me about the order of creation, does that mean that I'm okay if the order of creation is inaccurate? It doesn't follow, right? I could take a Verizon's position there and say that creation is not about science, but it doesn't mean I'm willing to tolerate scientific inaccuracy. Okay, now that same question has to be applied to history. Now, if you ask me the question, is the rest of creation about history, I have two questions. Number one is the purpose of the rest of Bereshit designed to convey to me information about certain historical events accurately because it's important that I know that these things happened? Or is the purpose of Bereshit designed to convey a historical narrative that has all sorts of interesting lessons for me? However, I am picking the narrative that teaches me these lessons from the set of true narratives, not from the set of fictional narratives. Right, I can take the position that Bereshit is not about history, and nonetheless be compelled to believe that everything in Bereshit is accurate history, or I can take the position that Bereshit is not about history at all. If I'm even interested in history, Bereshit is about edifying narratives, and the only reason that one might be interested in the narrative actually having happened is perhaps when narratives are true, they have more force. So if I have a choice between a true and a fictional narrative, I'd rather take the true one. Okay, yes.
I don't know that this is an important point, but I'm not clear on the distinction that you're making here between science and history in Bereshit, because the kinds of scientific claims that you're talking about in the paper Bereshit are all actually historical claims, right? They're historical claims that we happen to get to by means of the physical and biological sciences, but ultimately they're claims about things that happened in the past and not necessarily claims about natural laws.
Some of them are. Right, some of them are. Some of them may, you might argue with certain things of basis in telling you something about the nature of relationship between matter and energy, right, or if it's teaching me, right, in particular ways, by setting up a particular time scheme, it's teaching me that, in fact, there is a relationship between gravity and space, between gravity and time. But also, these are real examples, right, some of the arguments people have made. Not necessarily. I'd say that people, right, you can argue that they should teach me molecular biology also, if you want to. Okay. So let's ask the... Right, those are the, right, so I want to set those up as the questions, right? You know, we want to ask both the question of whether the interest of the text is to teach us about science or history, and secondly, whether we are compelled to, right, whether or not that is the primary interest of the text, is it willing to take poetic license for whatever other purpose it's seeking to convey, or perhaps really the whole question is off because the text is entirely uninterested in that. Right? For example, perhaps the text is just interested in being allegory about something, and we're taking a metaphor literally. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what Sur is. So the first page gives you an image. You have two options. One is that says that the Torah could have been given to Ezra, except that Moshe would be into it. And ends up claiming that historically, so the compilation site Ezra got is that he changed the script that the Torah was written in. If this takes the position, probably following the Halakhic Machloket, that whether the Torah, the script of the Jews in the desert, was what we now call, in Talmud, called Tavi Bri. For the script that we have now, which is called Tavla Shuri, the Talmud is fully aware of the archaeological evidence that there was, that during Bayit Rishon, certainly, Jews wrote in a script very different than what we call Tavla Shuri. We call Tavi Bri, which is a much more pictographic language, which makes sense out of the names of the letters, for example, Adalit. And Adalit, Tavi Bri, is a triangle, with a triangle because it's the door, the Talmud. So the question is whether, if you take one vision of Talmud that originally Kabbashari is the original language, it gets shifted after the desert period and then it just shifted back, or this Midrash seems to take the position that actually initially it was written in Kabbashari, and sometimes right after the beginning of Bayit Sheni, Ezra instituted what we call Kabbashari. Okay. But in the position that the Torah would have been given to Ezra had it not been preceded by Moshe. Now this is often used, trying to get on the second axis of the shir, by people who want to accept such criticism and believe that the Torah was put together by Ezra. So let's say, look, we can solve the theological problem because the Talmud says that Ezra was good enough to have the Torah given to us. We just take that position ourselves. So I tend to just think it's valuable to put that mission in context, and Talmud also has a statement that says Adam Rishon could have been given the Torah, and again, that sort of tells you that we're dealing with a kind of midrashic trope about, you know, who were the great people in history. So I'm interested in this context, though, is what would the Torah have been like if it had been given to Adam Rishon? We have had a story in which a Torahless group of people, having been slaves in Egypt, go out to a mountain in the Sinai Desert, and God reveals himself to them, and there they accept the Torah? No. Can't be, right? That would be silly. Right? Nor could the Torah given by Ezra. So it had been the same Torah as the Torah reveals the Moshe. Because the history... But it's not just so much that, you know, you can't say, well, they would have written it through prophecy. It wouldn't have happened. You know, the experience of the game of Torah at Sinai is not the same experience if you already had it. Right? And it would be silly to write a book about the experience of the game of Torah at Sinai if you didn't. Right? So what it tells you is that there's some notion of Torah which is independent of the specific historical context of the text as we have it. The Maral has a beautiful image, which my wife thinks that she introduced to me, but I will assume that she did. I think that's the idea that, I think it's bringing out the idea that what she told me very early in our relationship, which was, she said it to me, I said, I'm going to steal that one from you. And I have now done so well that I no longer recall that she's the one who told it to me. Except when she reminds me. But the moral of this notion of the Torah as an object that exists in a, you know, a multidimensional world, but at least a six-dimensional world. And the text that we have is its projection into our four-dimensional space. And just like if you take a pyramid, right, and you compose it on two-dimensional objects, right, it might look like a circle, and it just looks like what the base is. It doesn't look any different, you know, and you can have the same, depending on what angle you focus on, how many dimensions you vision in the same object, can appear differently. So what we have, but what we have is the projection of Torah into time, and how it looks depends on what angle, you know, where in time it's projected. So that presents the notion that there is some kind of essential content of Torah that is independent of the specific historical manifestation. And in that context, it makes it more plausible to argue that the story is not primarily about history. What lets you tolerate historical inaccuracy is a much more complicated question. I think it's true. I think it could have been Ezra. I don't think it means it could have been Ezra just in back at Ezra lived 2,000 years ago. I think it could have been Ezra except that when Ezra lived, there was already a Torah. Okay. I'm not pegging myself on this, right, on this midrash. Okay, I also wanted to give you, again, this was more relevant to the other three blacks of the share, but in session number two, you see that on these issues, I want to say up front that there is a tendency to try and draw boundaries in the Orthodox community on these issues. And so it's important to be aware of the opposing traditional positions about the question of whether people should engage in and are entitled to follow the conclusion of their intellect in these issues, even if they seem to lead to heretical consequences. So we have the Shubhat Vaz, which is a very valuable thing, that basically says that people can't be held responsible for reaching wrong independent intellectual conclusions. And so if that's where people's analysis leads them, then they're innocent. As opposed to the Stamtsotzer, who takes the position that one is required to believe whatever the current consensus of the Jewish people is, independent of whether, you don't have to necessarily get to the question of whether what you believe is true. You simply have to believe it because it is the current consensus of the Jewish people. So you should be aware of those two positions. Even according to the second position, of course, you always have the issue of what constitutes the consensus and who gets the votes. On this, there is the wonderful debate about the attempt to revive real halachic sefa in the 16th century. So the Rambam has this interesting position, which he suggests that we can revive real halachic sefa, which means the authority of the Sanhedrin, which really is supposed to be handed down person by person from Moses. But the challenge is that there, for certain purposes, it needs to be recreated in the Messianic era. How can that be? If we lost the Sanhedrin version somewhere in the, right, somewhere late in the Amoraic period, probably, or early in the medieval period. So the solution that Maimonides offers in one place is that if you have a consensus among all the rabbis in Israel that as to who the person is who deserves smicha, then you can revive smicha. So one rabbi decided that, in fact, he was the person whom all other rabbis could agree would get smicha, and therefore he had revived smicha. To which another rabbi wrote back that I can demonstrate to you that you are not the person who is unanimously concluded by the sages of Israel deserves smicha, because here I am a rabbi in Israel, and I don't think you deserve smicha. Right? So I have an unfalsifiable claim, right, against your claim of unanimity. To which the response, of course, was an explanation about why he didn't actually deserve a vote. you go back and forth that way. So that issue has its own. Okay. So I'm going to actually, I want to try and address one aspect of the history question first, and then go back to the science question, and then try and connect the science question to the history, and hopefully along the way teach a really cool reading of certain sections of Rishis, so that everybody feels that they got something. If you made it for some time before for walking in here, you were here. One of my class professors held it, at least when he gave a Tanakh class in college. That was his test. At the very least, if you made a Birkat HaTorah before walking into class, you should not feel the level of trouble walking out. In the graduate school, he made what must be. But in the college, that was his test. Okay, so what I want to talk about is the phrase which becomes famous as an example of an example of possible post-Mosaic text in Torah, which is the phrase Akhania of ours, in Bereshit Yud Bet. Okay, so at the very beginning of the Amram story, so it says, Vayom Rashem Lebram, Lech Lecha Meretz Malach Nebit Avita, good, so when I go to the place where I'm going to show you, if you're not comfortable reading Kalash in Hebrew, so you should please take Kalash in English, because I'm sorry I didn't produce complete translations. So we're chapter 12, verse in chapter 12. So Avram takes his whole family, they leave to go to town, now we're in verse 6. Vayavor Avram Baharat Am Lekom Shem Ali Lom Mereh. So Avram passes through the land until the place of Shem Ali Lom Mereh. The Akhnavi has the Ares, and the Canaanites are then in the land. Okay, so now why is it necessary to tell us that the Canaanites are then in the land? Who cares? So, if you turn the page, so you discover that, let's look at the second source, which is Ibn Ezra. In Ezra says, Baknali has the earth, the Canaanites are in the land, Itapench earth Canaan, custom Canaan Yadachir. It's very plausible that the land of Canaan was grabbed by Canaan from somebody else. The men of Canaan shall sow them up till you don't. If that is not the case, then there is a secret attached to it, and no one understands it should be found. Okay? There's always, irony in teaching this. Let me teach you the halakhah in Morin Canaan. This is halakhah in Morin Canaan. We're not supposed to rule according to. Okay. So now this has been a matter, Spinoza seized upon this and argued that this was evidently in Ezra's second position, the position of the sows, was that that this text was written at a time when the Canaanites were no longer in the land. It was necessary to rely on the historical context for the statement of Abraham, and therefore the text of the Canaanites was then in the land, as opposed to now, right, written from the perspective of whatever this editor is speaking, when the Canaanites are no longer in the land. Now, the presumption of this, right, of this argument is that that accurate historical context is important to this narrative. Right? You have to know that the Canaanites were in the land in order to understand, the story, as it really matters that the Canaanites were in the land. Right? You have somebody standing later saying, people will read this story and not have accurate historical context. Let me provide accurate historical context. So, ironically, the person who imputes post-Mosaic authorship has to assume that the writer at least really, really cares about historical accuracy. Okay. And then this first position, though, is entirely different. This first position is that this tells us not that the Canaanites were then in the land but are no longer. Its first position is that the Canaanites were already in the land, having not been there previously. It's likely that the Canaanites had grabbed it from somebody else. And so Ben Yazmaris means that although before Avram had come, the Canaanites were not in the land, now they are in the land. That's the here is following Rashi. Rashi says, Ben Yazmaris, Hayel leish b'kovesh et erich yitzhomi zah rosh al shem. So the Canaanites were going and taking the land from the descendants of Shem. Shem b'chokho shal shem nasuach yishachalak noach et arit zemanav, because the land of Canaan actually belongs to the Semites, right? And Melchizedek is Shem, and Melchizedek is Noah Shalem. They go into a whole school like that. Now, which of these readings is more accurate? I'm leaving aside the question of whether that is in fact the Sota of Ezra. But which of these two readings is more accurate? The reading that says that it means the Canaanites were already in the land, or the Canaanites were then in the land? So to my mind, the first reading in there, the reading of Rashi, is obviously correct. And the reason for this is in Bereshit Perek Yud-Gimel Pasuk Zayin, and exactly one chapter, one verse later. So we discover, right, so, by he reads in Rehane Knev Rabo Vein Rehane makes me say, look, Zachnani Vahafrizi Az Yoshe Bar. There's a fight between the Canaanites, the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Avram, at which point the Canaanites and the Perizzites are then in the land. So now in order to take the position that we're dealing with post-Mosaic editorial assumptions, we have to claim that two different editors of two different chapters were independently inspired for no particular reason to add in a historically accurate context over which accurate comments about which people were in the land when Avraham had this, when Avraham was traveling and then when Avraham was going through. These two narratives were then combined in the presence of a third editor, by a third editor who did not have the authority to remove either of the previous editorial introductions. This needs to be a very elaborate historical circumstances. Yes, Russ.
Isn't there also a problem with the fact that the second one includes the previous one?
Yeah, and so you have the claim that the first editor only put in the Canaanites, the second editor put in the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the third editor, having put this together, did not feel compelled to harmonize this, and did not have the authority to change either one, and therefore I believe so. Okay, that's why this is, I enjoy teaching this when I was doing this year about this stuff. It's a little criticism because it seems to me that the parade example from which it all supposedly started is a really bad example. Because it's really, it seems to me utterly implausible that Akhenani Ezra is referred to the past, right? It means that the Canaanites we then are longer as opposed to the Canaanites who are already in the land. But it still raises the question, why do we care? And yes, just here.
But if you want to
one law author,
and then there's no
draft
solution,
that
it was just already
clear
once, and you
still
have to ask the question, why
is it twice? Good. Why is it necessary? We still have to ask the question, why is it correct? And we have to ask the question, why is it here twice anyway? And we have to ask the question, why is it the Canaanites the first time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites the second time? So the answer to that, Rashi points out very easily, the answer to the second question is that since we're dealing with a progressive conquest, right, so what we're showing you is that first there were the Canaanites, but even as Avraham goes to land, the conquest of Canaan by the non-Semites and the Semites is continuing, and now the Canaanites and the Perizzites are both here. Right, so we're dealing with a progressive conquest. Now in the second case, right, in fact, it's also important to mention two nations, because it's sort of funny, right, because what do Avraham and Lot fight about? Oh, look, there are two of us. This land isn't big enough. By the way, there were two different nations moving into the land at the same time they weren't fighting. Right? Two individuals, right, an uncle and his nephew, right, there just isn't enough land for, right, it's like, two kids fighting, this town isn't big enough. This town isn't big enough for us. Well, several hundred thousand people wander around with us. Then you go to New York City. Saying to your cousin, one of us has got to leave because the town isn't big enough for the two of us. Yes, Joe.
So you could just say that it was getting very crowded there and there really wasn't that much room anymore. But not in room for either of them.
No, but they divide, right? They say, well, you take that half of the land, I take that half of the land, right? We'll draw a line down the middle of their town. Right? That's why it's important that the second time to have two as opposed to one. But the underlying this, what Rashi's understanding of this story, right, what Rashi is really telling you, is that the purpose of this line, the reason it has to say Akhenani Ezra Aretz, as Avraham goes through the land for the first time, as Avraham makes the Kenyan, and as Yisrael, as the Kenyan comes up, going through all of Eretz Yisrael, is because it's important to understand that God does not give Avraham the land, right, in place of its legitimate owners. Right? And in the rabbinic understanding of what's going on here is that you have to understand that Eretz Canaan is supposed to belong to Shem. At the very moment that God promises, Eretz Canaan to Avraham, the legitimate owner of the land, the Shemites, are being dispossessed. And God only promises Avraham the land at the end, right, when Shalem of Ohim will reach. When the sins of the conquerors are complete, so they deserve exile, they have no right in the land anyway. And so the whole purpose of these statements, according to Rashi, according to the whole rabbinic narrative, is designed to put a moral context for the gift of Eretz Canaan to Avraham, to tell you that God does not give land arbitrarily to its favorites and dispossess other people in their place. But all God is doing is making Avraham the legitimate heir of the Semites who are currently being dispossessed, and furthermore telling him that he won't be able to fulfill this promise until all the previous heirs have been completely dispossessed and their replacements have sinned to the point that they deserve exile. Okay, so Akhenani Ezra is part of a much larger moral scheme. Right? It's not about providing historical context for a narrative, it's about providing moral context for a narrative. So it seems to me that in this reading it's great. In this reading, we're not, the Spinoza reading is that this line of these was written solely because of interest in history. You have to add historical context. In this reading, history as such is just a means of conveying the moral point about the way in which God relates to land and the legitimacy of the Jewish claim to Eretz Yisrael. Now the question is, to what extent does this depend on rigorous historical accuracy? What does it mean exactly that the Canaanites were then in the land, then the Kuwait, then the Pedites? Or can you say that as long as it's true fundamentally that there was originally a semi possession of Eretz Yisrael, they were dispossessed of something? That I think is a bigger question. I am perfectly comfortable seeing it as exactly historically accurate. I don't know that it is a theological necessity in the same sense. Okay. That's a brief introduction to the question of history. Again, recognizing, as we talked about last week, that whenever you reduce reality to words, you always have to make choices. And the shot I gave 2 weeks ago was, ask somebody to write an essay about the color of a ceiling tile, it should take 7 million pages, because it's really complicated. You have to write, so atoms have colors, right, there are patterns, does it depend on, right, does it depend on your perspective, if I have glasses, right, so if I have glasses, do my face show the way it appears to me, or the way it actually is, because I see lots of different pixels together and jammed together. So, you know, if you want to write about the texture and all those things, so we don't, you know, we say it's the gray streak white ceiling tile. Now, it's not quite true, but it's close enough. So a statement like, the Canaanites are in the land, may be accurate on the same level as the gray streak white ceiling tile, without raising any major theological challenges, I think. Yes?
But it's also very important that it says that Abraham left to go to the land of Canaan, and then he came to the land of Canaan. So you have to explain why it's called the land of Canaan.
Yeah, so why would it be?
Only because
of Canaan
already there?
I don't know. There are lands that are called, from the perspective, there are places in Kamash where all traditional interpreters will agree that we use names because that's a name that's known later, even though it wasn't true at the time that text was said. I'm not convinced you have to do that. Okay. Now, what about... what about history? Sorry, what about science? So what are the first and second, what is Bereshit about? So you can assume that Bereshit is about the order of history. The problem with that, as everyone already, all of you are perfectly aware, is that the first and second chapters of Bereshit contradict each other in all sorts of interesting ways. Some really interesting ways, like whether Adam is created first or last, whether trees, right, you know, how trees grow, some more peculiar ways, like whether birds are created out of land or water. And you can take the position, and you pretty much have to take the position, if you believe that the primary interest of Bereshit is to convey science, you have to take the position that there has to be a way to harmonize these two narratives. And so you end up saying that birds are created out of mud, right? Because half land, half water, right? That's the way that's the harmonization that Rashi offers for that. Now, part of the challenge of dealing with these contradictions is that, as the biblical critics point out, if you take a look, and now we're in text number 4, if you take a look at what we'll call the first creation narrative, which I'm going to assume for now, the Shabbos is part of the first creation story, and ignore the Christian parents take up. So the first creation story, which runs from Bereshit Aleph Aleph to Bereshit Bet Gimel. So I have created some kind of weird font to show you all the names of God. And you discover that all the names of God all the way through, the only name of God that appears is Aleph Lamed Hey Yud Mem. Whereas, if you take a look at what we shall see in the story now, called the second creation story, which runs from Bereshit Dalish through the end of Bereshit Gimel, we discover that the name of God consistently is Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei-Elohim. So the first critics argue that this demonstrates that actually the contradictions are real, and the
we have here, if we're trying to convey science, we're conveying contradictory notions of science, neither of which, at least one of which is false.
If one believes that the primary interest of Voracious is to convey to us what happened as such, right, to convey factual information about the original Genesis, then the answers we have are kind of feeble. Right, I don't think the answers against the unified narrative are terribly convincing. Emerges to me the way I usually get the share. Right? Because the way I get the share on still like this junior stuff. So this follows. Rashi addresses the question of why we use the name Elohim in the first chapter and the name Hashem Elohim in the second chapter. And the answer Rashi gives is that Elohim is the attribute of justice. Yudke Vavke is Hashem, is the attribute of mercy. God thought about creating the world, Allah Mashallah, to create the world with justice. He saw that it would not survive. He joined mercy to it, right? So God thought about creating the world with Elohim, and then he just thought it would not survive, and he created the world with Hashem Elohim instead. Now, what I like arguing based on this Rashi, this Rashi fundamentally tells you, is that Bereshit Perek Aleph is divine science fiction. Bereshit Perek Aleph is the story of the world the way God would have created it had he created it with justice. But he didn't. That's a nice way of getting rid of Bereshit Perek Aleph. There's no connection to history whatsoever. Bereshit Perek Aleph is a possible alternative history and I tried this on occasion. Students often get the idea. If you just ask them to look at Bereshit Perek Aleph and ask what genre of literature is, they tell you that it's science fiction. Not because they have, because most of science fiction, particular genre, is written under heavy biblical influence. As is Bereshit Perek, somebody who's read C.S. Lewis will automatically recognize Bereshit Perek Ben Gimel as being, that's just a version of Perelandra. Right, although it's really the other way around. Yes.
This is not an argument, but isn't it like a childish thing that the world created and destroyed before our world ended?
Yeah. So why, who cares? Right? Well, that's have a point.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, it's fine, right? You can reduce trace to turning all the, we have to ask, like, what is doing here, and why this world, why not the other thousand? Yes.
Because, it's not theoretical, what we say.
That's a good question as to what kind of influence does this hypothetical world, right? It has to matter.
It's not hypothetical.
No, Shabbat is real, but Shabbat does not come from the first character of Bereshit.
But it's justification
for
why not
any five. Okay, good. That's a fair question. That's a fair question, and it's worth thinking about. I haven't actually done it well enough to figure out how we play out, because there are a whole bunch of origins of the Shabbat. There's also the Man. There's also right, but the Aseret Dibro goes really back to raise it this way. I should have never answered that. I don't have a good enough answer. Okay. So what I want to argue is that at least Bereshit Aleph, according to Rashi, has nothing to do with science. And that's why we could ask the question of what Bereshit Bet is, or whether Bereshit Bet has to be history either, or if it's just conveying a different perspective. Now, this is not so the reading of Rashi is perhaps a somewhat original reading of mine, but all of you are aware that fundamentally this is the approach taken by the Rav in the Little Nine States. That the two stories of creation are designed to convey two different aspects of humanity in this, and there's no attempt to reconcile them, and the Rav succeeded by the Nitzvah, and many other people have taken it that way. What I want to do today is complicate the case I just gave you, and then use that as a mode of addressing a whole set of other historical questions. So usually when this is presented, and it's how it's why my shooting used to end this way.
you say, well, look, Bracious Perik Aleph is Yuzer Elohim, and Bracious Perik Bet and Gimel is Hashem Elohim, so we have two creation stories, and we go home. But the truth is that there really is a third creation story, at least, which is the Bracious Perik Hei. We have the Sefer Tzoldot, but at least human beings. Our human beings are created a third time. And if we study the patterns of the use of divine names in Bereshit, sorry, Dal and Hay, we actually discover a whole set of interesting things, things as well. In Bereshit, Perek Aleph is all Elohim. Perek Bet and Gimel is all Hashem Elohim. Perek Dalet begins, Adam Yadat Kavi Ishto, Vatar Vatil Kayin, Vatomer Kaniti Ish Es Hashem. So Perek Dalet begins with the first use, and I should point out that Hashem Elohim does not appear anywhere else in Chumash. After the second and third paragraph of Bereshit, Hashem Elohim as a combined name vanishes. Perek Dalet begins with Vatomer Kaniti Ish Es Hashem, and ends, let's take the Chatei Chavav, right, so the first child, the Adam Yadav Ishto, the Tavis Yadav Kain, the Tavis Yadav Hashem, but the Chatei says, Vayeda Adam Odet Ishto, the Tavis Ben, but the Kras Shemo Sheik, Hishat Mi Elokim, Zerachir, Tachat Nebel Kiyar Yadav Kain. Okay, so Terek Dalet begins with Yud Kei Vav Kei, and the first child, his name, his name on the basis of Yud Kei Vav Kei, Tanisha Yud Hashem. But the replacement for Hevel, or Hevel isn't named at all. Hevel is nothingness. And the replacement for Hevel is Sheik, Hisham Elohim Zerachir. So all of a sudden, the relationship between Hashem and Elohim is totally confused. And then it ends up by saying, Atu Chaldi Krob Hashem Hashem. Which is even more confusing. Perek Hei goes back to Elohim. Right, that serpent of the right beginning of Perel, that serpent of the Dam, beyond the Elohim Adam, the Mut Elohim Asalto. But in Pabu's Chatzet, it says, Vayikrat Shmo Noach Limora, Zayin Hachamenu, Unayitone Zayin Minah Adamah, Hashem Yorah, Hashem. Okay, so you have Perek Dalet, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei Elohim, and then Yud Kei Vav Kei and Perek Hei, which is all Elohim, but ends up at one moment, and Elohim all the way through, right? Perek Hei, right? It says Elohim is in Pasuk Aleph, Elohim is in Pasuk Chaf Dalet, Elohim is in Pasuk Chaf Bet. Right, and all of a sudden you have Hashem. So it seems to me, when I started going through this, that the pattern was more complicated. It wasn't enough to just say there were two creation stories, and those two creation stories are designed to convey dialectic truths about the nature of human beings. So, what really is going on in this story? So I want to just set out I'm not going to do the whole argument tonight, and also it's not well developed enough. This is sort of here. This is still a thesis in formation, trying to integrate the whole set of positions about the issues. But it connects to the issue of what are all the begats about? Right? So putting Nal and Hay, if you look at them, they're all begats. Right? X beget Y, and live X number of years. So that's a primary locus for the question of whether we think that Bereshit is about history or not. Either the guest actually telling us who gave birth to whom, or is something else, something else going on, and now we discover that the names of God actually play a serious role in the begat. So now, it is also the case that if you take a look at the line of the genealogy of Cain in Bereshit Perek Dalet, you'll see I have numbered the names in the genealogy of Cain, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. You can see 1 through 6 are in Sukkot Yud Zayin and Yud Chet. And then if you look at the genealogy of shapes in Terry K, you'll discover that fundamentally the same names appear. Right? So whereas Cain has, right, so Cain is matched by Canaan, there's a Hanok in each of them, Yerad is matched by Yered, right, Mekuyael is matched by Mahalalel, and Metushael is matched by Metushelah, and Metulema. So it's also a peculiar thing that the begat seems to be, right, that at least one purpose of the begat seems to be setting up a parallelism between the lines of Cain and Shay. I owe my friend of Nathan Marine, who I have to say I think is the closest thing we have now to somebody who thinks like Kavel Balanidras did, which I was in Detroit. So I love listening to it. 3 points asked me after I gave this year this June that that's a really fun thing is that in Eric Dalit, Patrick of Dalit, right, asked this Lelema finishes his peculiar song to Hawaii, and he says, Kishiva Tayin is Kam Tayin, Lelema Shirin Vishiva. Whatever that means, just listen to the language. Yeshiva Tayin is Kam Tayin, Lelema Shirin Vishiva, and then take a look at Terek Hei, Patrick of Dalit, which, right, where the other Lelema is, like he called him Lelema, Sheva Vishivim Shana Oshdame Oshana. Alright, there's another really fun parallelism. Alright, the one where each Lelema has 3 sevens. At the conclusion of the genealogy. Okay. What does all that mean? So I'm going to start with a very broad thesis, and we'll see if it convinces you. What goes on in the beget, right, is we have the line of Cain, and we have Hevel. Hevel doesn't survive at all. And Hevel vanishes. Hevel is replaced by Shate, and then Cain is wiped out, and only Shate survives. Right, that's the normal narrative of biblical history through the flood. Now, the only thing is that it seems kind of peculiar that Cain is wiped out because God really likes Cain. We start with that God turns to that God bothers to talk to Cain when he's upset about Hevel's sacrifice. God doesn't kill Cain, right, even though Cain is a murderer. So that's stage one, right, that God seems to have, ironically, even though Cain is a murderer, right, Hevel doesn't get any prep at all, and right, God has a real relationship with Cain. Now, what are the characteristics? What's the characteristic of Cain? So I'm going to take a shorthand position of Cain, which may be plausibly obvious projection. Right, that the key aspect of Cain is that he has a sense of humor. The best thing about Cain is that when he is the first thing to say about Cain is that Cain is sarcastic. Right? When God asks him, where's your brother? He says, Asherah Yanofi. I can write that I am your brother's keeper. And then God punishes him for killing Hazel, and he looks at him and he says, according to most, at least the Rishon that I'm going to take those purposes, because all of them, you mean yourself, is my sin to grace the bear? And he actually says, look, you hold the upper and lower worlds together, is my sin to grace the dead? And then the most fun thing is, so God sends us into Nod and Nod Baharit, to be a wanderer in the land, and what does Cain do?
He goes to the city.
Instead of going Nod and Nod, he goes to the land of Nod. And his solution to being a Nod is to be, right, is to be a Nodnik. Right, he built a city. And he built a city. He tends to be not a Nod. He doesn't go to the Nod to build a city, right? So I think he's, and also the Cain was a farmer, despite the fact that God cursed the land. So you have Cain is for the two aspects which I will claim are perhaps connected, which is that he has a sense of humor, and part of having a sense of humor is the capacity to play with language creatively. Now,
the way the Midrash understands that the fall of Lamech to his wives is that Lamech says to his wives, Lamech's wives refuse to sleep with him because they say, guess what? God said that Cain would have seven generations, and our children are the seventh generation of Cain. They're all going to be wiped out. There's going to be a flood. They're all going to be wiped out. There's no point having children. So Lamech sings a song to his wives, and when she says, well, you know, I'm not anywhere near as bad as Cain. I haven't killed anybody. So if Cain got seven generations, I'm going to get 77. Turns out he's wrong. But you see, Lamech, right, now the reason he's wrong is that Lamech is in fact the true descendant of Cain. Nothing has changed in the seven generations. The evidence of this is that the specific claim the wise make is that Lamech is the, right, Lamech is the person who recreates blacksmithing. And Lamech's children recreate blacksmithing, which means they forge weapons. So Lamech's wives talk to him and say, look, you're the, right, you're, right, you want to be, you want God to show mercy on you when you are the, right, the, your son is the seventh generation of evil murderer, and the seventh generation of evil murderer is going to recreate weapons. So Lamech says, and I didn't have time to do it tonight, but Rambam beautifully expresses, Lamech says to his wife, swords don't kill people. People kill people. Right, Rambam says literally, right, you think about your, well, kind of thing you tell us, right, El Hadam. Yes. Now, which to me means that Lamech is the true descendant of Cain, because his reaction to, right, the moral accusation is sarcasm. And so it's perfectly legitimate for God to wipe out Lamech, because seven generations of Cain has, right, there's no children whatsoever. However, if you look at the genealogy of, of Cain, Perek Dalet. So if you look at Perek Chaf, right, and these are all Lamech's children. And Lamech is the archetypical So it turns out that Lamech's children are called the fathers of all herdsmen and artists and technologists. Now, if Cain's line is wiped out, how does Lamech become the father of all music and technology? So, another mystery we have in the story.
I understand the question. I mean, presumably there were other people there too, right? So he's the inventor.
Okay, good. I want to try to claim, he had influence on Shape, right? He called it the Shape children.
So you think they were secretive deal? Maybe.
So I just want to point out that right after we have all these other years, the next line is this total mystery of the guest, where all of a sudden we have this peculiar interjection of a woman. So the Midrash, I think, correctly takes up that the, right, that Naama, of course, is the wife of Noah. And the point is that Cain's line survives because Shem's line marries him. Right, that all, right, that Cain's male line is wiped out. But in fact, Cain has a tremendous impact on the world. In fact, the usual way of conveying technology is to have, right, it's that intermarriage, right, and you can, right, you convey the... So if you actually look at what the purpose of these, what the purpose of these begats is, right, the purpose of the begats turns out to be an explanation of, on the one hand, why Cain's line is wiped out. On the other hand, the explanation that Cain's influence is not wiped out, right, because ultimately Cain's line merges with Shem's, because Shem's men marry, right, Shem's men marry Cain's women, and the world is actually divided as a product of the male line of Shem with the, right, with the female line of Cain. And I think also, I'm not going to develop it tonight, I don't have it really well worked out well enough, I think that will actually track the use of the nine names in the story, and that you'll then it will be possible to demonstrate that the use of Hashem Elohim in these chapters is right, tracks that notion of that the humanity survives when it is capable of combining Hashem Elohim in the same way that Perek Bet showed the world could survive when God combined Hashem Elohim, right? And therefore, when right, therefore the purpose of Perek Dalet is to show that Chava moves from when she names Kayin and she meets Hashem to she names Shait to Shami Elohim Derachir, and Noah is the combination of right of Yitzchak Rothkei and right Elohim. Okay, I think that it will be possible. To demonstrate that, and that's what you're writing off line, it's a Elohim that ends up in the last line of the Mashiach or Hashem. So I want to set out right, that the purpose of it's not just the two creation narratives. It's the purpose, right, it's all of the Bereishis up until the flood. It's trying to convey some kind of vision of human history. And the vision of human history, which teaches us that just as the world to survive needs both the attributes of Hashem and Elohim, which I don't want to limit to mercy and justice, and there are many different ways that Hashem and Elohim stand for different things. So human beings only survive when they can find some way of combining the aspects of a Elohim and Elohim in there. And the genealogies are set up. So has to convey this point. That's why all the same names, right? And it'll be right. And if you accept it, right, then Levine's point that you know that we have some linguistically having the second lemma, the lemma for shape one, live exactly the number of years which enables him to be a linguistic echo of the song of Kayan's lemma. Yes, sir.
Since you're doing them. First of all, why did I mention the whole, you know, creation of the world? And second of all, why is it we neglect to say where the rest of, you know, people come from?
Well, it's not a point. That's my point. It's not a history of humans. I mean, in the same way that the first two chapters are not a history of the world, the first two chapters are attempts to convey what it takes to create a survivable world. So the second two chapters, the next two chapters are not, or chapters 4 and 5, right, are not an attempt to convey the history of humanity. They're an attempt to convey what it takes for humanity to survive. Right? For humanity to survive is the capacity for human beings to achieve the same kind of balance that God combined. Right? So in that vision, then the question of whether it is a self act or not becomes irrelevant. Just as Bereishit Aleph is an attempt to convey a world that could not survive. Right? So, right, Kayin and Hevel each, in different ways, are descriptions of the kind of humanity that could not survive. And even Shait is not a humanity that can survive by itself. It's some aspect of the Kainite capacity of human beings, with some aspect of the Sethite capacity of human beings, that enable humanity to survive. And that vision, everything up to the model, is not history or science at all. Everything up to the flood, right, is some kind of meditation on what it means to be a human being, what it means to be able to survive. Yes.
So, the design of this structure, if you look at the standard of different critics and two sources, kind of the key with Hashem, are you saying that you're looking at this as a simple historical level, therefore you're having trouble reconciling it? But if you take it to the broader basis of Russian scene and look at it at the deeper level, there might not be contradictions because we're not already too far.
Well, so I think it's not my finish, right? That's the only amount of faith that you can resolve the problem of biblical criticism by saying that it's not talking about reality, it's talking about directly truth. The problem I have with that on the whole is that it's limited to the first two stories. And it takes as a given, and it concedes too much because it sees these as separable documents, right? You know, the J document and the E document, right? So my point is that actually, if you look at it, the more sophisticated pattern, where it's not, you can't separate out documents which are Yitzchak Melkein documents or Elohim. What you have is a long story which deliberately interweaves the names of God in ways that are thematically significant.
Right, that's the only critique on that.
That's all right. And so,
I mean, the argument against the first critical perspective is that actually it's not only that it sort of assumes that the text is interested in, right, it's interested in conveying historical as opposed to moral truth, as opposed to moral truth. It also doesn't. It's an insufficient attention to literary detail. Okay, Michael, you had a question. Okay, yes,
I feel like in some ways, it's interesting, because what you're doing, right, the model that you present, like, almost perfectly maps on to, like, just like for us, it almost perfectly maps on to the different sources.
No, that's exactly my point. Chapters 1 and 2 do, but they now come up with 4 and 5.
When you're talking about the two genealogies, right?
Yeah.
First, take those as the two separate genealogies.
So they have to assume that the use of names of God is an editorial mistake.
Not necessarily. What I'm saying is, I think you end up with some, where you're going. You end up with something like Charles Rosenzweig's position, right? Where are the redactors Romano and look at the beautiful job he did in interweaving these sources in such a way that we have
no, that's just that's very different.
It sounds like that's what
originally you were thinking of Charles Rosenzweig. Yeah, I guess we tend to think of it more like a lawyer's position in some sense, which is the assumption that the methodology of biblical criticism in terms of isolating documents is actually correct, and God for some reason shows the ventriloquist. I don't like that approach at all, because it doesn't explain too many of the accidental features. But if you conceive the point, then right, you have to say, so why does one you have to build the question, why does one document sound like it's written in Judean dialect, and one document sounds like it's written in Galilean dialect? There are too many concessions. So God, not only did God use language in ways where he wrote in two different styles to kind of get this point. What I'm arguing is that no, there aren't actually separable documents. And this, right, the interweaving of the names of God shows you that what you have is, right, shows you what you have is a single narrative, although the single narrative, they're not two narratives interwoven. Right, it's a single narrative which is bound together by the names of God as opposed to by the class between the names of God. Right, so I'm not ending up with the, right, it's because the expansion too, now, right, you can get rid of the source critical argument very nicely by dialecticizing in paragraphs and best, but actually concedes too much. What I'm trying to argue tonight is that actually you can demonstrate literarily, right, that the text as a whole is unified. Okay, yes, sir.
You also do that for the stylistic stuff, as you mentioned, the
discrepancy between the names. I'm not addressing that tonight. What I thought it was supposed to get a little criticism share, that whole thing. I guess I could, in response to that question, I can say, there are four kinds of arguments you can make from local authorship. Right, they're historical, archaeological, linguistic, and literary. And I have no expertise on the whole in any of the areas. Literarily, I have some expertise. I have very limited knowledge of linguistics, none of archaeology, and almost none of history. So I would say as follows. It's easy to come up with examples that make fun of all these. And I can do that. Right? I can tell you that, for example, there's an interesting debate about whether the Book of Samuel is a pro-Davidic polemic or an anti-Davidic polemic. Right? There's a, archaeologically, you can have fun. First of all, you can do the Tracy Kidder routine about the, right, so you have archaeologists digging up 20th century America, and they dig up this very important cultic building, in which they discovered that there were lots of, the way that 20th century Americans worked was they had these temples with lots of little chapels in them, in which you could, you could go in and into your private religious space, and there would be a shrine there with the god, and there would be the capacity to offer, right, and under the shrine of the god, there would be offered the food offerings, and you could pay to them, and you could take the offerings, right, and you could give them to the god, right? And they thought that as the archaeology of a motel.
It's a motel, right?
Where you're right, there's this big arc. Right, there's a little room. All the rooms are set up to face the ark. Right, there's some kind of cultic object inside the ark. Underneath the ark, there's a refrigerator.
Right? And there's no question that all of us would understand this as being accurate, as being accurate. But you can make fun of it, you're talking about linguistic evidence where in Sefer Eov, right, once upon a time people thought it was obvious that Sefer Eov was very late because there are Aramaic influences, and somebody just thought, no, it's really very early because there are Aramaic influences, and some billion person discovered that there's Aramaic influence early, there's Aramaic influence late, what are the odds of an Aramaic influence somewhere in the middle? So as a total amateur, they can make fun of it that way. That would be unfair. But I'm glad to have the excuse of doing this. Rosh Hashanah, while he was responsive, you know, saying all the way through Shear, like the whole Shear, just, you understand all this is wrong. Right? It's just presenting a position that you're going to knock down at the end of Shear, but it's so much fun to present it. But, you know, you have to remind you, because this is all wrong, by the way. So, almost anything that serious people put together, is not totally destroyable to ridicule. So I don't want to take the position of biblical criticism as ridiculous, although it is easy, right, as with most methodologies, to find examples of ridiculousness, and sometimes, particularly when you deal with an enclosed academic field that is not really open to critique from outside itself, ridicule can be a useful tool to try to get, outside it. I have a deep skepticism of almost all reconstructive fields. Fields that assume they don't actually create any evidence, but only interpret existing evidence and create apologetic stories about this. But my skepticism extends to lots of fields where people aren't so happy about skepticism. I have no religious, for reasons I just outlined, I don't see a basis for ecology that has anything to do with science. I have no religious issue whatsoever with evolution. I don't think the world is better off if we believe in specific creation of individual species, aside from the fact that in biology right now, the notion of a species is utterly incoherent. You want to take the position of creation of individual species, right? Now, this is also an interesting halakhic consequences, like the notion that we make a bracha on a lulav, because a lulav is a tamar, when our loving, are unlikely to be significantly genetically related to the biblical tamar. Right. Almost all our crops, our animals, all those things are genetically altered beyond recognition. So the whole notion, so halakhically we have to create some kind of notion of species, but scientifically the notion of species in many ways is incoherent. The notion that God created each individual species to me is not a coherent notion at all. But academically I'm not so fond of many theories of evolution that seem to me, to be reconstructive, just those theories with very little predictive value. So you should be aware, I'm not aware of all these fields, and I tend to be skeptical of all these fields, and it's not useful to, so my positions on that aren't so useful, that's what I would say. I am not convinced by them. You can read the Kitchen, right, as opposed to the other archaeologists, and you can read David Hazoni's article in Azure arguing against, that much of archaeology isn't biased. Isn't biased against biblical truth. You can watch the TBS special and look at the radical difference between the archaeologists who are sponsored by Shalane and the archaeologists who aren't. Okay, all of a sudden those who aren't are all, seem to be about the gap in the text. Right? The text is under archaeology, all of a sudden you get to the Shalane Mazur, right? The Shalane sponsored archaeologists, and all of a sudden everything is not confirmed, and then right there at the end you go back to the non-Shalane sponsored archaeologists. And all of a sudden But these are fields I don't know much about. I don't know enough about that. Literary stuff I can talk about. It seems to me that doing a literary analysis, that the literary argument for multiple authorship is far from compelling and often misses really important elements of the text. What you do with the other arguments is a different question. And yet, the theological questions, they go back to the base between the rebellious and stumped up there on level one. And for me personally, the one dogma of Judaism is that you have to believe the halakha is really binding. So I tend to think that you have to believe those things which are necessary if you believe the halakha is binding. Myself, I don't find a way to accept multiple authorship and believe the halakha is binding. And therefore I find it necessary to believe. And continue to believe. And unified authorship, but I also find it intellectually at least reasonable, and on true literary ground, compelling. Okay, so Matkah, so I want to I should qualify this. So this is what I want to suggest, that this is a literary reading of British from an Alex Juhay that in addition to making a compelling case for unified authorship, also makes a compelling case that the primary interest of fucking Alice to pay a bridge is not history. And the primary interest is a claim about what it takes human beings to survive. That does not take a position about whether it is entitled to be historically inaccurate. Because you might argue that it's nice that Lamech lived 777 years, and that ties in literarily with Lamech's song, Yeshiva Tainu Kam Tain, Lamech and Yeshiva. And if Lamech had lived 778 years, then God would have to surrender that particular nice literary touch and find some way, right? He might have written it, and Lamech lived 777 plus 1 year. Right? You know, to make it wise, so you could still have the 3 sevens in. Or he might have just left it out, written the Torah, which, you know, was lacking one really nice connection and found some other way of doing it. So what I would say is that understanding that the primary text of the primary interest of the text is not history makes it much less problematic theologically to take the position that it's not right, that historical accuracy is not a primary concern. But you're certainly entitled to take the theological position that it has to be historically true anyway. And it just seems to be it's not as important. However, I should say that Professor Sholem Carmi made an argument to me when I was a freshman in college that I always found was really, really valuable. I'm going to paraphrase his argument. I'm probably going to say things that he's not responsible for. So, his name here is the inspiration to the argument without giving him responsibility for the development. I think what he said to me specifically was that he was perfectly comfortable with Bridges not being history until Bahamadina. And I'm going to offer a theological explanation, which I suspect is what he meant, but which he never specifically offered to me. So the argument is as follows. Until you get to Avraham Avinu, there are no obligations which are grounded on anything happening to any subset of the human race. And everything that happens before Avraham Avinu happens to all the human race, and therefore there's no reason that history, if it happens to a symbol of the human race or it happens to the entire human race, it doesn't matter because all that matters is that this be a true description of the relationship to the human race and God. When you get to Avraham Avinu, right, all of a sudden you have obligations that aren't binding on the whole human race. The obligations that are binding on a subset of the human race. What's different about that subset is an historical claim, right, that we descend from Avraham Avinu. And at that point, so if you take Avraham Avinu as a metaphor, right, so then it should apply equally to all humanity, whoever finds the metaphor compelling. But that's not what Torah says, right? Torah says that the experience of Avraham Avinu is binding on his descendants and not on others. Right? So I thought that was a good theological argument. It's not an unevadable theological argument, but it's a good theological argument. That the historicity of Avraham Avinu is a theological necessity in the way in which the historicity of any character prior to Avraham Avinu is not. So I'm very specifically making the literary argument about the nature of humanity. It depends on go up the flood and no further. When you get to Avraham, I think it's much harder to do that. Now, I began the Kani Asbaris by saying that it's certainly not the purpose of Bereshit to write the comprehensive biography of Avraham Avinu. There are many aspects of Avraham Avinu's life that we don't know about in Sumatra that we're not particularly interested in. Okay, right? We don't have the fully detailed accounting of his crops. We don't know his business dealings. We don't know whether he washed the dishes regularly after supper. Lots of things we don't know about him, but we can project all these things depending which form of midrash you want to write. So, granted, what we have is that it seems to me there's a really good theological argument to require us to assume the fundamental historicity of the stories of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov.
a really, really good theological argument. I find it very compelling. I take the analogy seriously where people's philosophical positions take them so long as they end up being halakha's binding. I tend to be very, very liberal. But I find, personally, I find it a really, really good theological argument. So to me, the only question is, so when I show up, Nani has the art, the Kani is crazy, Laji Shay Baris. Right, so that, I think it actually does matter. To me, it actually does matter that Samash is portraying accurately that the Jewish people's claim to the land of Canaan is a moral claim, not a power claim. Recognizing that by doing so, I'm reading Samash like Rashi and not like Ramban, not like Rashi. Because Ramban argues that the whole purpose of Bereshit is to convey that God's apportionment of land is moral. Right? Whereas Rashi can't possibly be read as saying that the whole purpose of Bereshit is to convey that God can give land to whoever he wants. And we talked about that last week, and about that 2 weeks ago. So I am much more comfortable the more historical accuracy we, the more historical detailed accuracy we give to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, because I think that there's so much which depends on specific things having happened, arousing gratitude, modeling and things like that. There's still room for discussion about what Bereshit is. For example, the Rambam takes the description of Sodom and Amorah, or the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, for the Rambam, is utterly irrelevant to what happened. And the Rambam takes the position, based on a literary problem which has always bothered me greatly, the Rambam says that one of the lines in Samach that always bothered me tremendously was, Avram woke up the next morning and he went back to the place where he had stood with God and he saw that there was smoke rising from the land. How did he sleep? Right? How did he sleep? Right? Okay, 10 people, fine. Whoops, I guess there weren't 10 people. That doesn't make any sense psychologically. So the Rambam says that Avram was right, that Avram, of course, was asleep the whole time. Right? The whole conversation with God was right, all through his dream. And the destruction of stones is, right, we have it in Bereshit, is the destruction of stone as it was experienced by Abraham in his dream. Now it happens that Abraham's dream paralleled reality. That Abraham woke up from a dream about God raining fire and brimstone down on stone, he discovered that his dream was real because there had been a volcanic eruption. But the purpose of Bereshit is not to convey, right, the purpose of that narrative is not conveying the truth of a volcanic eruption. The purpose of Bereshit is to convey, there at least, is to convey what the natural world feels like when it's experienced by somebody with a deep religious sensibility. Right, so the claim that everything in the story of Avraham is literally historical, which I am very comfortable with, although I'm not so comfortable theologically mandating it for people who can maintain belief in the binding nature of halakha despite it, doesn't mean that one is required to take it as a literal historical description of what actually happened, as opposed to a literal historical description of how the character experienced it. And that's an important qualification. Because it might mean, for example, if you take Sefer Yoshua, and Yoshua says the sun stops, we don't care that if in fact the sun stopped, the world would have gone spinning off the earth would have stopped on its orbit and the whole world would have gone spinning. We don't care. What happened from the perspective of Yoshua is that God stopped the sun. Maybe what actually happened is that there was some kind of refraction phenomenon in the atmosphere which kept the sun below the horizon shining above. We don't care. Right, because the purpose of Tanakh is to convey the experience of the religious person. Right, so I want to just put that qualifier in, and then just say that again, it's a personal statement coming from every comedy that I'm much, much more comfortable using literary analysis in contrast to seeing something as historical before, from, and after. Yes?
Yeah. simpler to do a smart experience with a model, but the more hard to.
So no, you know, so A, right, county wide, no one else is around. Yeah, so A is not just done here. We know, for example, when Wilk has the experience of being the only person left in the world is not true. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just not true. Secondly,
it's his daughter who's the
person. That's what he argues with them, right? Yeah.
Right. He's drunk. They can't drunk later, but he doesn't say, why bother, right? You can just blow the heck out. So we know there are people who mistakenly believe themselves to be the last people in the world. That'd be one way out. I tend to attribute to the Radak, possibly unfairly, a really cool allegorical being in the novel, in which he argues that the message of the novel is, look, the difference between animals survive as breeding pairs, human beings survive as breeding pairs. So God knows the names of human beings. And that's the fundamental message of the novel, according to Radak. I am less Aristotelian. I think I said that I had this discussion, right? I said there's much more tough, right? Like the allegory better than I do. I like the reading, but I don't care so much about the allegory. I would say, if Carney's right, then it's perfectly fine to read the novel as telling us something about the fragility of humanity in a certain sense, as opposed to making a claim that actually there has to have been a flood which had X number of cubic feet that aged the worldview. But I'm perfectly, I think Carney's line is out of the line and out there, and I'm comfortable with it, and that seems to be a case where it's really hard to get around the archaeological evidence. I think that would be really, from what I know, it's really hard. I don't even need for that. I don't think there's any. I don't see any reason that anything in Bereshit at least has to make any kind of scientific claim. Because there are non-move works, fundamentally, right? You know, we tell the story from the perspective of the characters. I have no idea how Yaakov got the sheep to. Well, he thought he got it by finding sticks in particular ways. That's okay with me. Whatever actually happened. History had a much harder time after Avram, because it seems to me that the arc of Jewish obligation requires obligation to be generated by specific events and not just by stories.
Yes, I can.
I really like your approach here. I just want to highlight a bit based on a point that David gave me earlier. A lot of the distortions and the problems that we see in reading the biblical text, whether it's from the biblical critics on one side or the biblical literalists in the Kuhn community on the other side, are all leading to various types of problems and absurdities. All this is, unless if you are able to sort of get a sense of the framework and context of the main narratives of Bereshit, let's say even if you took each one as framed by Eleutodos, or if it is Eleutodos, this is only a new section of the framework, all within one document hangs together. But you know, and each one can, just the point is not to take our 21st century sense of chronology and history, which has a very specific understanding of time, based on clocks and based on scientific measurements, etc., and anachronistically projecting that back on the biblical narrative. And then, when you do that, it leads to absurdities, whether you be it as a biblical literalist or as a documentary hypothesis person. Your point is that, however it is, whatever it is, the real context and core theme of each narrative is, you have to focus on that in order to read, in order for the whole biblical text to kind of focus properly. Otherwise, you're going to get distortion. And I think that's a very valuable way of looking at it. You may have recently done ideas. My names have come up on an organizing theme for the first main narrative of Bereshit. It may be that or some other something similar to that or something shifted from that, but the very nice approach is that it, you know, we should not be projecting our sense of history, science, philosophy, even literature, you know, back on the biblical text, and then, you know, coming up with, you know, distorted readings of it. We really have to understand the biblical text, you know, on its own terms, but I think that's what you're getting at. I think that's a very valuable approach. So.
Thank you. Last point I just want to make is just to notice what I used last 2 weeks ago. I think it's always useful, and the defender refers to it also, that we, the notion we have of historical accuracy being, meaning that you have to get all the details exactly as they were, is a 20th century phenomenon. Whereas, and the metaphor I gave is, you know, the backdrop for a stage production, that pointillistically accurate text, all right, backdrop is totally unconvincing. Right, we need a backdrop that is to paint it vaguely in such a way that it will be, that the audience will understand it literally, and it can be enjoyed. And historical writing pretty much before the 20th century took that approach, recognizing that you have to, right, the question is not whether you painted it with perfect accuracy, the question is whether the audience came away with an accurate picture. And because the brain interposes layers of interpretation, the most accurate painting does not necessarily convey the most accurate picture. And so I think that, you know, one should say that the purpose of Sera is to convey, it's for us to emerge with the most accurate picture of Avramis looking at those. And if one were to believe that the most accurate portrait of Avramis looking at those emerged from a form of writing that is not accurate in detail, and if we're looking at it from the point of view of an academic historian, I don't have a theological difficulty with that. I am perfectly comfortable religiously, most comfortable religiously, on the assumption that actually it all works out perfectly, and that that God managed to find a way to write so that the version which was most accurate in detail is simultaneously most accurate, right, conveys the most accurate impression to the author. I don't have any objection to somebody who makes that theological presumption. But if you ask me if somebody came up with the claim that God wrote verses in such a way that you emerge with the most accurate possible portrait of Avramis looking at those, even though it doesn't exactly conform, right, to in detail what actually happened in the same way as you paint a backdrop, right, I don't have a theological difficulty with that, although it's not my, you know, I don't have a necessity to say that either. All right, just to thank again, Alexander.